Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee Podcast. In this episode, we will hear Melissa Rogers present an American and Christian case for defending Muslims' free exercise rights. This is her second presentation for the 2011 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. Rogers is the director of the Center for Religion and Public Affairs at the Wake Forest University Divinity School. She gave this presentation on the campus of Georgetown College in Georgetown, Kentucky.
Well, as you know, I'd like to make an American and Christian case for defending the free exercise rights of Muslims. But first, I need to briefly address two foundational questions. The first is, what is included and excluded when we talk about free exercise legal protections? And the second is, why am I focusing specifically in this talk on Muslim free exercise rights? Well, let's start with the free exercise matters. As you know, the First Amendment to our U.S. Constitution says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The first clause is the Establishment Clause, and the second clause is the Free Exercise Clause. Now, the Free Exercise Clause protects the ability to practice one's faith, which includes engaging in things like worship and prayer, the construction and operation of a house of worship, including a synagogue, mosque, or church, and the wearing of religious garb, whether it's a headscarf or a yarmulke or a cross necklace, to school or to work. And free exercise rights are protected not only by the First Amendment, but also by other federal and state law. And a key principle running throughout many of our religious freedom protections is that the state cannot single out a religion for disfavor or for favor. It can't single out a religion for preference or for discrimination. Instead, the government has to stay neutral as between one religion and another religion, and also between religion and non-religion. So the government can't either overtly or covertly favor Baptists over Baha'is or Methodists over Mormons or vice versa. It can't discriminate or favor one religion over another. Now, there are obviously limits to this freedom, right? Clearly, all of our liberties have some limits to them. One clear limit on free exercise rights is that they do not shield acts of violence, of course. If it's asserted that human sacrifice or stoning, for example, is a faith practice, the government certainly won't protect it. It will intervene to prevent it. And if a group engages in terrorism and somehow claims that they are religious or that that is a religious practice, then of course the free exercise protections provide no shield. Further, free exercise protections don't block the government from investigating a community, including a community that says it's religious, if the government finds that there are threats emanating from that community about violence. So, for example, you may have heard of a recent case involving a group known as Hutari. Its members described themselves as Christians preparing to battle the Antichrist, and they said that they were going to do so by getting together improvised explosive devices to blow up police officers. And they said this was part of their faith group practice. Well, of course, that certainly didn't stop law enforcement from investigating this group, and later a federal grand jury from indicting members of this group to prevent these threats to public safety. So the government clearly must have the latitude to protect public safety and national security. Wherever it finds those threats, it has to go after them, even if they come out of a group that says it's religious. The First Amendment does not and should not rob law enforcement of the tools it needs to prevent violence. Well, what about the second foundational question that I mentioned? Why am I focusing specifically on the rights of Muslims, the free exercise rights of Muslims? After all, in the United States, we all have free exercise rights of all religions, and I myself am a Christian. So why am I focusing on the free exercise rights of Muslims? After all, the three branches of our federal government have long recognized that Islam is a religion and it as such, is protected by First Amendment and other protections, and the basic constitutional principles are clear. The government has to treat all faiths equally, protecting the free exercise of every faith and establishing no faith. But, of course, at least since the attacks of September 11th, the American conversation about Muslim free exercise rights has taken place in a challenging environment. Even though studies have found that the overwhelming majority of Muslims condemn terrorism, the fact that a series of terror attacks have been committed in the name of Islam has triggered fear and has raised questions among Americans. And while there are many different interpretations of Sharia, which serves, as you know, as a guide for Muslim living, the term has become, in the words of Professor Noah Feldman, radioactive. Many look at Sharia and say it's defined solely by reference, for example, to cases like Iran's sentencing of a woman to stoning for adultery. Thus, as Professor Feldman has said, Sharia, and I quote here, conjures horrors of hands cut off, adulterers stoned, and women oppressed. In the fall and summer of 2010, two events converged to turn up the dial even farther on our conversation in America about the place of Islam and free exercise rights. And those two events were that it was campaign season for a midterm election, and there was a pitched battle over plans, as you know, for an Islamic center a few blocks away from the site where the World Trade Center towers once stood. In this context, some particularly bald challenges emerged for Muslim free exercise rights, and I want to just list four broad categories, if you will, of these challenges. One was some people suggested that Islam might not qualify as a religion under the First Amendment, and thus would not deserve any First Amendment free exercise protections. You may recall that the Lieutenant Governor of Tennessee said that he had some doubts about this, and a group of Tennessee citizens actually filed in court to asking the court to declare that Islam was not a religion under the First Amendment. The second category of challenges that we've seen are anti-mosque protests that have been held in a number of cities and towns across our nation. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life has reported that in the last 2 years there have been at least 35 cases in which mosques and Islamic centers have been met with community resistance. Indeed, the Department of Justice has opened 14 cases since May 2010 regarding the ability of Muslims to operate or build mosques in American cities, and it's connected these cases with suspected anti-Muslim bias. The third type of challenge that I want to discuss relates to discrimination complaints in employment and education. There was a hearing that you might have watched on TV last week that Senator Durbin held. And at that hearing, there was congressional testimony by a Department of Justice official, Tom Perez. And Mr. Perez said that there had recently been a spike in complaints regarding discrimination against Muslims in employment and education. Complaints, of course, are particularly wrenching when they involve children. And Perez said that one parent had told him that more than 20 students at his son's school were calling his child a terrorist because of his faith and ethnicity. The fourth kind of challenge involves this concept of Sharia that we've already talked about a little bit. Sharia meaning this guide for Muslim living that covers a range of topics, prayer and divorce and poverty, a whole bunch of subjects that governs really the lifestyle for Muslims in a religious manner. In November 2010, Oklahoma voters added an amendment to their state constitution singling out Sharia for disfavored treatment, saying that state courts couldn't consider it in their rulings. Now, this is despite the fact that the Constitution already bars the substitution of religious law for civil law. We already say that with our Constitution. Whether that religious law would be Muslim, Mormon, or Methodist, we say that you cannot replace our civil law with religious law, and obviously properly so. Lawmakers in several other states have proposed similar measures, and some have even said we need a federal law like this. In February of this year, actually, some Tennessee lawmakers introduced a bill declaring adherence to Sharia to be, and I'm quoting here, prima facie evidence of an act in support of the overthrow of the United States by the likely use of imminent criminal violence and terrorism. The number of threats to the free exercise of the Muslim faith make this a particularly disturbing case. The nature of these threats do as well. For example, as I've already said, if a court or another governmental body was to deem Islam not to be a religion, it would not receive the protections of the First Amendment and so many other free exercise protections. And when we think about it, it's not hard to realize that there are fewer foundational threats to a religious community than to say that it can't come together for worship or can't build a structure in which to worship. When there are protests against that kind of freedom in many cities across our nation, I would say that that should get our attention. Further, suggestions in a piece of legislation, no less, that the mere practice of a faith amounts to treason presents an obvious, stark, and serious challenge. You can practice your faith, or you can be an American, but you cannot do both. Now, let me be clear. There are threats to the free exercise of many different faiths in America, including my own Christian faith, and with the Baptist Joint Committee, I'll be fighting those threats. I'm unaware, however, of a pattern of threats like these to the fundamentals of any other faith in America, and that's how I chose my topic for this morning. So let me turn to that topic now, the Christian and American case for defending the free exercise rights of Muslims. Well, in the face of the threats I've just described, let's first consider what, if anything, is the responsibility of Americans. And I'd like to advance an argument here that we do have a responsibility. But some might say, well, wait, the government's job is to defend constitutional and civil rights. They're the ones that have to do that. What does any of this have to do with us? Well, I think it would be a serious mistake to think that there is no need for civil society to be actively engaged in the defense of constitutional and civil liberties. Well, what do I mean by civil society? Well, that's just a fancy word to talk about associations, advocacy groups, groups like the Baptist Joint Committee and many others, secular and religious communities and social movements that form together in America around shared interest. It is often said that civil society is one leg of a three-legged stool that supports well-functioning societies anywhere in the world. One of the legs of the stool is a responsive and accountable government. Another leg of the stool is a thriving private market economy and all that entails. And this third leg, again, is civil society. Everything else, advocacy groups and communities and movements. Benjamin Barber has said that civil society is a realm we create through associated common action. Civil society often shapes governmental officials' understanding of what's actually happening on the ground and why that matters. Civil society plays an important role in asking the government to tackle certain matters or shuffle its priorities. Members of civil society often are pressing the government to say, here's a new law we need to address this problem, or here's how you can use an existing law to address challenges that are emerging. Well, the next question would be, should the defense of the American Muslims' rights, should they be left to the Muslim portion of American civil society? Well, adult Muslims represent something less than 1% of the American population, so that might not be a winning strategy if we left it there. Thankfully, however, in our country, we have a long and illustrious tradition of defending each other's rights. And I want to talk about that tradition for just a few minutes. Probably the best known example is the struggle for racial justice in the 1950s and 60s. Obviously, African Americans led in that struggle, but they didn't fight alone. Many white people came to join the battle as well. In 1949, for example, after having graduated from law school, Jack Greenberg went to work for what became the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this organization. His boss was Thurgood Marshall, And with Marshall and other lawyers, Greenberg prepared their case in the landmark case of Brown versus Board of Education. And we all know and celebrate the fact that the Supreme Court rendered a decision that in that case demolishing the separate but equal doctrine. And many of you as college students, I'm sure, have studied about what happened in 1964 when nearly 1,000 volunteers, most of whom were white and very young college students, facilitated voter registration of African Americans in the South. It was known, of course, as Freedom Summer. Now, in his letter from a Birmingham jail, Martin Luther King Jr. explained this principle that drew people of different races together for this common aim. He said, and I quote, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. We are tied together in a single garment of destiny." Frederick Douglass subscribed to this belief as well. As you know, Douglass was an African American who escaped slavery and then worked for the emancipation of his fellow slaves. He also spoke on behalf of women's rights, specifically women's rights to vote. And at a meeting of the Women's Suffrage Association in 1888, Douglass said, "When I ran away from slavery, it was for myself. And when I advocated emancipation, it was for my people. But when I stood up for the rights of women, self was out of the question, and I found a little nobility in the act." Also, time and again, people in groups of one faith have defended the rights of people in another faith group. And this is, of course, what the BJC has done with such great distinction for 75 years. For example, when the government has tried to prevent Jewish men or boys from wearing yarmulkes, or nuns from wearing habits, or Sikhs from wearing turbans, people that don't have any faith-related garb requirements have spoken up. Like John F. Kennedy, these religious leaders believe in an America where religious liberty is so indivisible that an attack on any one church is an attack against all. Men and women and movements like these have reinforced the notion that we aren't Americans because we're the same race or because we're the same religion. We're Americans because we subscribe to a set of transcendent ideas and values, including equal justice under law and religious freedom for everyone. And because we are Americans because we insist that all Americans are entitled to the blessings of liberty and the dignity of justice. Well, I've tried to make a principal case for Americans as Americans to defend Muslims' free exercise rights. I also want to highlight some pragmatic issues here, if you will, some pragmatic aspects to this case. Time and again, a variety of law enforcement officials have said that they cannot effectively combat terrorism without the partnership of the American Muslim community. By providing crucial and timely information, Muslims have often played key roles in preventing terrorist attacks on American soil. In 2008, for example, FBI Director Robert Mueller said that many of the cases that they had worked on were the result of tips that they had received from the Muslim community in the United States. So they had been able to use those tips to foil terrorist attacks and other kinds of threats of violence. Indeed, recently, some law enforcement officials said that they had foiled the last 7 of 10 terrorist plots because Muslims brought information forward about these plots. And you may be familiar with some studies from the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. They found that Muslim Americans have taken a number of positive steps to reduce radicalization. They not only provided information about terrorist plots to law enforcement, mosques and other Islamic communities have done things like sponsoring anti-terrorism workshops and forums for youth to head off a sense of alienation and a sense of indoctrination and radicalization that might result from their contact with certain people. These mosques and Islamic centers have also barred certain speakers from speaking after they have done a check about their background. Well, you can see, therefore, that thwarting the building of American centers and mosques would often mean thwarting some of our best weapons against terrorist attacks. Now, it should not be surprising that so many Muslims are highly motivated to prevent terrorism, Many of them are obviously very committed to peace and safety, like all of us are. But another factor is that a West Point study has found that the vast majority of Al-Qaeda's victims are Muslim. So Muslims are getting the brunt of this kind of terrorist activity abroad. Well, we nonetheless hear, and often we hear it in the rhetoric today, that all Muslims are somehow responsible or to blame for the evil attacks of a lunatic fringe. These are guilt by association tactics. They're wrong and counterproductive. They are also a waste of precious time and resources because they focus us on the wrong threats. They focus us on people who could be our partners and not on actual threats. So what we can do in contrast is respect the free exercise rights of Muslims. That is an excellent way to strengthen the bonds of friendship and respect and to deepen working partnerships between the government and Islamic communities so that we can do that and address threats of violent extremism, which are real and which do need to be addressed along with protecting free exercise rights. Further, protecting the free exercise rights of Muslims in our own country helps to underscore the message that America is not at war with Islam, and our commitment to the principle of religious freedom is not simply rhetoric. And if you'll recall, former President George W. Bush set us on the right track here, and he did so early on. To his everlasting credit, Bush went out of his way to visit a mosque 17 days after 9/11. And on September 19, 2001, and many times thereafter, President Bush said, "The war against terrorism is not a war against Muslims. It is a war against evil people who conduct crimes against innocent people." In 2002, former President Bush spoke at West Point saying, and I'm quoting here, "America rejects bigotry. We reject every act of hatred against people of Arab background or Muslim faith. America values and welcomes peaceful people of all faiths, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, and many others. Every faith is practiced and protected here because we are one country." In a press conference in September 2010, President Obama echoed and added to these sentiments when he said, "Our country stands for the proposition that we all have inalienable rights, and one of those inalienable rights is the right to practice one's faith freely." He continued, and I quote, "I've got Muslims who are fighting in Afghanistan in the uniform of the United States Armed Services. They're out there putting their lives on the line for us, and we've got to make sure that we are crystal clear for our sake and for their sake. They are Americans, and we honor their service. And part of honoring their service is making sure that they understand that we don't differentiate between them and us. It's just us. Indeed, soldiers of all faiths and none have fought and died to protect our freedoms, including the ability to practice our faith. And it's my belief that the least those of us who can do, who have not been in the service, is to speak in favor of these freedoms here at home." Let me turn to a different question. Is there a Christian case for defending the free exercise rights of people of other faiths, including Muslims? My answer to this question is an emphatic yes. The Genesis stories reveal that God created us all in His image. There is an imprint on the divine on each of us, and we should treat each other, we are taught as Christians, with that dignity and respect. The Bible also reveals that God created us with the freedom to choose, including in matters of faith. It is this freedom to choose that makes faith so meaningful for us. The fact that we can say no to God makes our yes to God so deeply meaningful. The Bible also teaches us that Jesus said Christians should love God with all our hearts, our souls, and minds, and love our neighbors as ourselves. Part of loving our neighbors as ourselves is protecting our neighbor's ability to practice their faith and to have other freedoms. I think, for example, of Muslim-majority countries where the rights and safety sometimes of Christians is often at risk. Many of us ask Muslims to help us in those countries to protect the rights of Christians. And if we want those Muslims to help protect our rights, then we must return that kind of treatment and work to protect their rights as well. So what I'm trying to say is Christians have a duty to safeguard the ability of each person to listen to and follow their conscience and to practice their faith free from coercion. And that includes all kinds of coercion, but the most dangerous kind is the kind that comes from the state because of its enormous coercive power. The Bible also has much to say about justice. Smearing a whole faith community for the heinous acts of a few who claim to be one of them is a deep injustice. And Brent Walker of the Baptist Joint Committee used this analogy recently, and I'd like to use it here as well. As you know, the Supreme Court recently ruled in a case involving a group calling itself the Westboro Baptist Church. They make it their practice to go to military funerals, services for men and women who have made the ultimate sacrifice on behalf of our country. They don't go there, I'm deeply sorry to say, to provide comfort to these families. Instead, they go there to torment them. They have signs that say unspeakable things like, "God hates you." Along with every Baptist body and individual that I know, I condemn these practices in the strongest possible terms. They are antithetical to the teachings of Jesus. Would it be fair, then, for others to assume that the so-called Westboro Baptist Church speaks for Baptists? I'm a Baptist. And that their behavior is sanctioned by Christian scriptures? No, that would be a smear and a deep injustice. In the same way, it is a smear and a grave injustice to say or suggest that Muslims who peacefully practice their faith and condemn terrorist attacks perpetrated in the name of Islam are responsible for those evil acts. We remember that the prophet Micah teaches us, what does the Lord require of us? To do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with our God. May it be so. Now, let me be very clear. Defending the right of a person of another faith to practice their faith is not the same as defending the truth claims of another faith. Defending another person's ability to practice their faith obviously is intended to clear the way for them to practice their faith. But there are some important words in that sentence. It clears the way for them to practice their faith. It is simply wrong to say that advocating religious freedom for everyone necessarily includes advocacy of the beliefs of all other faiths. Likewise, defending the right to practice a different religion is not the same as giving up one's ability to criticize another religion. We do that all the time. Roger Williams, indeed, is probably the best example that I could think of for this category. Williams, as you know, was a 17th century Baptist preacher and founder of Rhode Island Colony as a refuge for religious dissenters. Williams defended the rights of Native Americans and Quakers and everybody to practice their faith as he saw fit. And then he quickly added, "But I disagree with you." He said there was no religious freedom without freedom for all people, in his words, for the paganish, the Jewish, the Turkish, and the anti-Christian. But then he said he did not endorse these other faiths at all. He said, indeed, he actually caused some very public arguments, for example, with Quakers, where he said, "My religious beliefs are right and yours are wrong," even while defending their right to practice their faith, of course. And of course, history is filled with instances in which people promoted freedom and liberty to express thoughts with which they deeply disagree. You often hear it said, "I don't agree with what you have to say, but I'll defend your right to say it." We get that when we're talking about free speech rights. It's the same with free exercise rights. We disagree perhaps with one another on faith issues. In fact, I'm sure we do. But we want to defend each other's rights to practice our faiths. Likewise, there's no contradiction between calling on the government to protect the free exercise rights of people of other faiths and sharing our own gospel. Both are essential, and both may be practiced simultaneously. Indeed, I would say that defending free exercise rights for everyone sends a powerful message of love and confidence in one's faith. Pastor Rick Warren sung from this hymnal when he spoke to the Islamic Society of North America in 2009. He said, and I'm quoting here, "You know that obviously, as an evangelical pastor, my deepest faith is in Jesus Christ. But you also need to know that I am committed not to just what I call the good news, but I'm committed to the common good." Warren emphasized that he was committed also to the defense of the freedoms of speech and religion. Likewise, today there are campaigns that unite Baptists, including the Baptist Joint Committee, Evangelicals, Methodists, Presbyterians, and many others, in defending the equal rights of Muslim Americans to practice their faith. Well, there are also some pragmatic reasons for people of faith to defend the rights of people of other religions. After all, every religion is a minority faith somewhere, including in the United States. When precedents are established in one region that discriminate against the minority in that region, they will likely be used against other faiths that are minorities in other parts of the country or the world. And in a congressional hearing last week, Senator Lindsey Graham said it well. He said, "I must stand up for your religion if I want you to stand up for mine. We are all in this together, fighting for freedom and protecting our country." And as that last statement would suggest, Senator Graham stressed in this hearing that it was important not only to look, as I said earlier, at the deprivation of the free exercise rights of American Muslims, but also at recent acts of homegrown terrorism, including acts committed in the name of Islam. And I quite agree with him. I fully support the efforts of Congress and the rest of our government to study these issues carefully and to work diligently, obviously, to protect, to prevent terrorist attacks of all kinds. Even as the government goes forward with protecting the civil and constitutional rights of all people, we can and must do both. Well, let me conclude. With a national election not too far in the distant future, many of us are concerned that this issue has become increasingly politicized and that will continue. That would be a great shame, because religious freedom for all and equal justice under law are not democratic values. They are not Republican values. They are American values. Indeed, the principle that the government must apply the same standards to all faiths is in many ways the linchpin of the American tradition of religious freedom. Adherence to this principle has helped us to make peace and build solidarity in a nation where a stunning array of religions are practiced, often side by side and frequently with great fervor. Contrary to the suggestions of some, honoring this standard of religious freedom has not made us weak, it has not made us submissive, it has made us strong. Thank you. Thank you so much. I want to welcome your comments, questions, views, raising of issues.
He began his career at a law firm and then felt God. He began his career at a law firm and then felt God. He needs to be doing churches, spread the message of religious freedom.
Who left Virginia because
teacher.
This institution is
preacher,
many of you know, whatever
was
teacher.
This institution is
preacher,
many of you know, whatever was
step in when there is fear mongering going on about a religion or anything else, perhaps is your question. I think that the government would not have a legal responsibility, but an ethical responsibility to do that. And I think the statements that I mentioned of former President Bush were particularly strong in that regard, and his visit to a mosque so soon after the attacks were particularly powerful. So I would think and argue that it would be an ethical responsibility. I think the legal responsibilities only come for things like
Rittenhouse came across the mountains to this place where he could have
Rittenhouse came across the mountains to this place where he could have
The Baptist Joint Committee is indeed pleased to co-sponsor with Georgetown
College, right? 2 years before that little place up in
District of Columbia was founded in 1789. So it's good to be here at the... As I always remind my friends in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Dr. Krause, and good morning.
This is the original George
Babbs Joint Committee.
As I always remind my friends in Washington, D.C., this is the original George.
Say that is an example of, like the Westboro Church, an exercise of a liberty with which I deeply disagree. And I think that we have heard from so many since this individual has raised his threats, so many Christians and people of many faiths who have cited that golden rule principle that I should not treat another faith group's sacred text in a way that I would not want my sacred text to be treated. So I think there's been an outpouring in that. I also would say that I think the media has done a much better job this time around than they did the last time around about not giving this particular individual coverage. Now, we're still trying to sort out what has happened as a result of his act, but I would, along with what I said about the Westboro Baptist Church, certainly condemn that on the same terms as I did that act. But at the same time, recognize in all cases that we should never respond with violence to those kinds of issues. We should respond with more speech to that kind of speech that we deplore, and not with violence to these kinds of acts. Yeah.
I'm aware of at least one faith that practices and teaches polygamy. And from what I'm
the original briefs in the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Baptist Joint Committee has advised in Washington, D.C. for 75 years in the U.S. Supreme Court, defending and extending religious liberty to the administration. Everyone.
When violence, when practicing violence. So I'm just curious if was the government.
Not just for give commentary for the national media, do a lot of.
Well, when the government did speak, and you're correct about them reacting in that way, and the courts that have spoken to that, I don't think that they have spoken to it as an issue of violence, but rather other issues, other risks, other threats, and you know those decisions are somewhat controversial, as you well know. But I think what is clear, what is absolutely crystal clear, is that the free exercise protections provide no shield for threats of violence or actual violence. And then backing up from there, you can get controversy about many other things. Any other questions or comments? Well, I want to thank you for the time with you this morning. It has been a wonderful experience. I'm so grateful to Georgetown College and the Baptist Joint Committee and the Sheridans for giving us this opportunity to have this conversation. And I wish you all the best in your studies and your work.
That was Melissa Rogers presenting a Christian and American case for defending Muslims' free exercise rights. Rogers is a former Baptist Joint Committee General Counsel, and she served as the first chair of President Barack Obama's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. She delivered this speech in 2011 as part of the annual Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. For more information on the Sheridan Lectures, visit our website at bjconline.org/lectures.